if we end up as the film depicts in 2055, the tragedy is that it goes against everything that made our species special. I'm a geneticist, and I'm always amazed at the way scientists today can use DNA to track the movement of human beings over the planet in the past. And all of the trails lead back to Africa 150,000 years ago. We're all Africans in our origin. And try to imagine what the world was like in 150,000 years ago. There were still woolly mammoths on the planet. There were still saber-toothed tigers. There were giant sloths all over North America. There were 9-foot-tall moa birds. The world was a very different place, and the great savannas of Africa must have been covered with animals beyond anything that we could imagine from the Serengeti today. So try to take your brain and go back 150,000 years. Imagine the great plains of Africa. You'd have to look very hard to see little clumps of 3, 4, or 5 of these funny-looking two-legged furless apes. And that was us. Now, you got to admit, we weren't very impressive. I mean, there weren't many of us. We weren't very big. We weren't very fast. An elephant can outrun the fastest human on Earth. We weren't very strong. A chimpanzee weighing 100 pounds could beat the crap out of me. And I'll bet out of every one of you, too. And I, you know, we weren't endowed with special senses. I mean, look at the number of us wearing glasses. I always try to imagine swinging through the forest on a vine. I'd never see the next vine. I'd fall and get eaten up by a saber-toothed tiger. I mean, I am sure 150,000 years ago, no other species said, "Hey, watch that naked ape, man. They're going to take over the planet." I mean, what the hell did we have going for us? Well, of course, the answer is you couldn't see our secret. It was that 2-kilogram organ buried deep in our skulls. The human brain was the secret of our success. The human brain had a vast memory. No other mammal on Earth has the memory capacity of a human brain. We were curious, and we were inventive. And those qualities of memory, curiosity, and inventiveness more than compensated for our lack of physical and sensory ability. And that brain did something very special. It invented an idea called the future. The future doesn't exist. The only thing that exists is now and what we can remember from the past. But because the human brain invented the idea of a future, we are the only animal that realized we can affect the future by what we do today. Based on our knowledge and experience, we can look ahead and see where the dangers lie, see where the opportunities are, and we can deliberately choose today to avoid the dangers and exploit the opportunities. I believe foresight was the great ability that got us to where we are now, the dominant animal on the planet, because we looked ahead and we used our knowledge to avoid the dangers. And today, we have all of the increased ability to look ahead. We have scientists. We have supercomputers. We have engineers in telecommunications. And for over 40 years, a leading scientist of the world have been telling us we're headed down a very dangerous path. And now the tragedy is that we are turning our backs on the very thing that got us to this position of dominance, of looking ahead. 20 years ago, there was a major conference in Toronto. 300 atmosphere scientists met here. Stephen Lewis told me that he was appointed by Brian Mulroney to chair some of the sessions. 1988, those scientists were already convinced that climate change was happening and that humans were contributing to it. They said, we have to reduce emissions right now. And they called for a 20% reduction in 15 years. Think if we had done it. If we had done it, we would be way past the Kyoto target. But we didn't. And that's the great tragedy of our time. We had the ability. We've done study after study in my foundation using technology that is on the shelf today. This isn't pie in the sky, oh, maybe we'll do this, maybe we'll do that. This is what you can buy today off the shelf. We showed that Canada could reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by over 50%, but it would take 30 years. If we start now, we could get going and we could make massive reductions with technology we already have. But look at what we have today. We have a government that says, ever since he was our prime minister, Mr. Harper has said, we can't do anything about Kyoto. It'll destroy the economy. So what he's going to do is take the futures of you young people here And he's going to say, I can't do anything about your future because it's going to cost too much money. First of all, this guy is supposed to be smart. That's what we're all told. Stephen Harper's the smartest guy in the room. Wait a minute now. If he's so smart, why is he lying to us about climate change and the economy? Sweden is a northern country like Canada. Sweden is a northern country like Canada. Sweden decided that they were going to take the climate change seriously. They have imposed a tax on carbon, which everybody agrees is the most effective way to begin to change our use of fossil fuels. They imposed a carbon tax in the 1990s. Today, they pay $120 a ton to put carbon into the atmosphere. British Columbia, we had an election over a carbon tax, $10 a ton. It's now $15 a ton. Sweden pays $120 a ton. They have reduced greenhouse gas emissions 8% below 1990 levels. And during that time, their economy grew by 44%. What kind of a leader of this country, who is supposed to lead us into the future, would say a deliberate lie that it will destroy the economy in order to meet the Kyoto target? I want you to know that the industrialized world created the problem of climate change. We are wealthy beyond imagination. We agreed at Kyoto, the industrialized world had created the problem, and it was our responsibility to show that we can cap our emissions and begin to bring them down. And then by 2012, there will be a new agreement where all the countries in the world would come into it. As soon as Kyoto was over, Alberta and Canada began to say, what kind of a deal is this? India, China, the developing world, it's not fair. Wait a minute now. China, India, all those countries were there at Kyoto. I was there. And we in the industrialized world agreed at Kyoto. We created the problem. And it was up to us to show that we could cap and bring our emissions down. But what are we saying? No. The Chinese are building a coal plant every 4 days. What the heck's going on? They're going to take us down. They produce per capita a quarter of the emissions of every American. And yet we use that as an excuse. Canada is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Alberta is the richest province and one of the wealthiest countries in the world. If Alberta and Canada can't afford to do anything about climate change, when will we be able to afford to do anything? And if we're not willing to do anything, why should China or India or Indonesia or Brazil pay any attention to this? And they can go and follow the same path we did. And there's another issue. At the meeting I was at that Kofi Annan called in June, he showed that the 50 poorest countries in the world have collectively contributed less than 1% of all of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They have not created the problem, and yet 95% of the impact of global warming is already being felt by the 50 poorest countries in the world. There is a moral obligation here. They had nothing to do with climate change, and yet they are the major victims of it. Do we not have a moral obligation? And yet, look at that disgusting display in England about the wind farms. Let me tell you, it's happening right here as well. There is a movement here not to build those windmills offshore here. It's got nothing to do with human health. It's got nothing to do with bird kills or bat kills or any of the other phony baloney arguments you're hearing. It's, we don't want it because it's going to destroy my view. Not in my backyard. And we really have to make people confront the fact we are now in a very serious situation. Canada is one of the top polluters in terms of greenhouse gases on the planet per person. And it seems to me we have got a huge obligation to begin to reduce our emissions very, very drastically. That's the challenge we face. We don't have to go to the future depicted in this film, but we have very, very little time to do anything about it. For the last 4 years in Ottawa, every politician in Ottawa has only thought about one thing, and that is, when the hell's the next election and how do I get reelected? For the last 4 years, they've been focused on who's going to vote for me. Well, guess what? These kids don't vote. For that matter, their kids don't even exist. What politician is going to go before the public and say, vote for me because I'm going to look out for future generations? Baloney. They're looking out for the people that voted for them or that paid for their campaigns. And now what's got to happen is these children, these young people, it's their future that's at stake, not old farts like me. I'm in the last part of my life. Whatever happens or doesn't happen will have very little impact on my life. But it will reverberate throughout the lives of our young people today. You've got to be involved. You've got to go and tell these guys when they're running for office, you better bloody well be looking out for your future. And the thing you've got to do is to recruit the two most important people on the planet, your mom and dad. Your mom and dad say they love you. If they care about you and your future, then they've got to become eco-warriors on your behalf. We don't have time. Let's get going. Okay, over to you.
Thank you, Dr. Suzuki. For tonight's question and answer period, we'd ask that you keep your questions concise and to the point and formulate them in advance in order to have as many questions asked as possible. When you do have a question, we'd ask that you make your way to the front of the auditorium. There's a microphone there and a microphone there, and you can ask your question there. So let the questions begin.
I read somewhere that the in situ processing of the tar sands was going to consume as much natural gas as the rest of the country put together. That sounds pretty bizarre to me.
They're going to use natural gas, which is the cleanest form of fossil fuel. They're going to heat water till it boils and pump boiling water into the ground so that the tar... And it's tar, it's not oil sands, it's tar, until that tar melts so that we can then suck it up and process it. And we will use, if we allow that to develop, Canada will use as much natural gas as would heat every home in Canada, just to melt that tar and extract it. We'll use half of the energy you get in a barrel of oil will already have been used trying to melt it and get it out of the ground.
So it's like either we drive our cars or heat our homes. Bizarre choice.
Well, most of it is going to the United States. It's not even for us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I have one main question, and that's... So in the past, people would have said about safety, it's going to cost too much to focus on safety. Or about pollution, it's going to cost too much to reduce pollution. But we've chosen to do that as a society, and now this creates jobs in our society, and in fact it's something that I think we all feel strongly about working towards. How do we do the same thing with climate change and change the talk from being cost to an opportunity?
I'm glad you brought up the auto sector, because it's true. Every time we've argued for some improvement, whether it's catalytic converters, whether it's seat belts or airbags or greater fuel efficiency, the Detroit Big Three have always argued the same thing. It's going to cost too much. The consumer will stop buying. It'll destroy the auto sector. We'll have to move or we'll have to shut her down. They have done that every time there was an attempt to impose a progressive act. And, you know, look at them now. They fought airbags for 10 years, even though Chrysler had evidence that it saved lives. So for 10 years, hundreds of thousands of people died because Detroit refused to give in and install airbags. Now look at the ads. Look at the ads for the cars. We got 6 airbags here. Wait a minute, they said one airbag would destroy the industry. Now they got airbags on the side and the front and everywhere else. I mean, this is, if we're going to have a discussion, let's have an honest discussion. When we look at the call for action on global warming, guess what? Have you ever seen all of these websites saying global warming is junk science? You ever heard this handful of people that are skeptics that say it's it's sunspots or it's something else. Guess what? They're paid for by the fossil fuel industry. ExxonMobil has spent tens of millions of dollars, as have the whole rest of the industry, setting up phony baloney websites to say this is junk science. There's a wonderful book out now called Climate Cover-Up. Read that and you will get furious, because all in the name of profit, they have created confusion in the mind of the public. They think, oh, well, it's still a controversy. The scientists are still debating. It is not a debate. But what they have done is to create unsureness on the part of the public. This is an intergenerational crime, what they've done. And to this day, our so-called pundits that are so smart, the people you read in the papers like Rex Murphy and Margaret Wente, they're all saying, oh, no, this is baloney. It's not really happening. And so we're still in a state of denial. So you say, well, how can the public, how can we have a discussion? It ain't a fair discussion, because all kinds of lies are going on that are passing for equal knowledge to compete with the scientific community.
Thank you.
The other thing is, we got no choice. If we continue with business as usual, not only will the planet be increasingly uninhabitable for a top predator like us, we're at the top of the food chain. We are the most vulnerable species on the planet. And our survival is now at stake. It's not about economics or anything else. It's about survival. And it seems to me that changes the whole nature of the discussion. But our so-called leaders in Ottawa still are behaving as if this... Have you ever heard the Prime Minister of Canada ever say climate change is a serious problem we've got to meet? Have you? I have never heard him. Does anyone here ever heard him say that? I don't believe Mr. Harper even believes it.
Thank you, Congressman Hamilton. Quick question. The independent scientist James Lovelock, he has a very pessimistic view of the future. And in some of his writings, he looks at nuclear energy as something that we should embrace while we put together a portfolio of energy, renewable energy. Yeah. What's your view on either the Gaia theory or the nuclear future?
Well, the nuclear
future?
Thing, first of all, if we're going to make a shift today, and we have to make a shift, we have to go towards renewable energy. The only sustainable future in energy is renewable energy. Oil or nuclear fuel are finite. They're going to run out. So if we're talking about a truly renewable, sustainable society, oil and nukes are out just on the basis that they're finite. The price of uranium is just skyrocketing. Why? Because there's a limited amount. Unfortunately, Canada is one of the major suppliers of uranium, so we see it as a huge advantage. But it's not a sustainable thing, and when you burn fossil fuels or when you use nuclear fuel, you end up with a problem at the end. So there's a real problem. It's not sustainable because it's non-renewable, and you have a problem when you use it. So why should we even look to nuclear? Today, nuclear provides 5% of all of the energy needs in the world. If we double nuclear energy, which would be a massive, massive attempt, it would take us up to 10% of our energy needs or energy use, and it would cost, nuclear is the most expensive form of energy that we have, and it would still take 10 to 15 years to double if we did an all-out effort. Think if you spent that money on renewable, we'd be well on our way. Forget it, as far as nuclear goes. As far as Jim Lovelock goes, eminent scientist, he has come to a very, very depressing position. The data all indicate where we're going. We've continued to rise in terms of our emissions output. It's absolutely right. We're heading, my analogy is, I feel like we're in a car driving at a brick wall at 100 miles an hour, and everybody's arguing about where they want to sit. Doesn't matter who's driving, someone's got to say, for God's sake, put the brakes on and turn the wheel. Unfortunately, those of us that are saying it, we're locked in the trunk. Nobody hears us anyway. But the point is, we haven't hit the wall yet. And until we hit the wall, I think that people like Jim Lovelock should just shut up and go away. Because there's no point saying it's too late. And I don't think any scientist knows enough to be able to say, well, there aren't some secrets that nature has that maybe nature will be more generous than we deserve. Yes, we're going right straight at the brick wall. But let's try to put the brakes on and turn the wheel before we hit it. And maybe nature will be far more forgiving than we deserve. But I don't think anybody knows enough to say with absolute certainty it's too late.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us tonight. In your opinion, is it more important to try and instigate a social change for raising awareness towards this, or a political change trying to get the politicians to raise their mind? Like in the movie, they had the people building the wind farms trying, even if it's a small portion, to raise awareness. Then they also had them protest. Which one is a more effective way to achieve the ends?
We have to do them all, obviously. I think that the really interesting thing right now in Canada is that Canadians have got it. They're concerned. In British Columbia, we've seen $65 billion worth of pine trees lost because pine beetles are not killed by the winters anymore. It's not cold enough. British Columbians know very well global warming's happening, and we're feeling the impact. The real action is taking place at the municipal level. There's huge activity going on. And, you know, whether it's renewable energy or energy efficiency, all kinds of things happening. And at the provincial level, there are real bright spots. Ontario has the most progressive piece of green energy legislation of any jurisdiction in North America. And that's because Dalton McGuinty has now taken the lesson from Germany, where they have a feed-in tariff. And when you have a feed-in tariff, you guarantee that any energy coming from a renewable source will get a top premium for a number of years. And that makes it possible for an individual farmer, a co-op, or even an individual landowner to say, gee, I can get a loan from the bank to build that windmill because I'm assured of getting a premium price for that. So believe me, the Green Energy Act is going to stimulate thousands of jobs in this province. I don't think there's any question. So Quebec is a very green province, but mainly because of hydroelectric energy. British Columbia has the only carbon tax in North America. So at the municipal and the provincial level, there are a lot of exciting things that are going on. Right now, the problem for Canada is that we have a prime minister who runs the government with an iron fist. He comes from Calgary. His father was an executive in an oil company, and he is beholden to Alberta. And so we've got a real problem here, and I think the challenge then is to make these guys understand climate change is real, and we as voting citizens care about it, and it's going to be a major part of the next election.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for coming to Hamilton again. It's a pleasure to see you. I'm surprised to see you. I wonder how many students know, and I hope you can explain to them, that when you said Alberta was a rich province, could you explain about the pipelines and all the refineries that have to refine that crude and how far along they've gone? They're all along the Great Lakes now. And the NASCO corridor, the people don't even know exists. What's the itinerary here? The states have already sucked out all the oil. They've piped it. They're being refined on our lakes, polluting our waters. And the states knows about the water levels rising. That's why the NASCO highway is happening. And people look at me like I'm daffy, but NASCO, just go look at it on the web. If the coasts get flooded, there's going to be a big corridor right up through the middle, and it has four outlets in Canada. People don't even know that.
That sounded like a statement, not a
question. No, I mean, I'm hoping that you could explain that.
I don't know.
You don't know about that?
No.
You don't know about that? That scares me. Okay.
I'm just one guy.
All right. So it's happening. Google it. You can find it out. I'm sorry I put a question to you that you couldn't
Thank
quite.
You. Now, you look like a go-geet from Haida Gwaii.
Oh, I don't know about that either, but I do know I'm representing corn, the vegetable community at the moment. And thank you for being here.
Are you genetically modified? Or
no,
actually,
I'm a recycled piece of corn from an anti-GMO campaign a few years ago. So we pulled Cornelius Corn out of the closet and is putting him to work again. I'm representing the Canadian Catholic Organization for Development and Peace, and currently we're running a biofuel campaign looking at the impacts on human rights and especially on the environment when it comes to biofuel production and using products like corn. Corn, in my opinion, my very humble opinion, is meant for people, for food, not for fuel. Now, there might be many other types of agricultural products that would be better put to use for fuel. I was just wondering if you could comment on this, Dr. Suzuki, and share your opinion.
Well, I think that as farmland disappears, it's crazy to use food for humans and convert it into food for cars. But isn't that the way that we have set our priorities today? If you look at our cities aren't for humans. They're built to serve the car. When I was a kid, growing up in the 50s or 40s, I can remember around 5:30 in the afternoon, back doors would open and moms and dads would come out, Johnny, Mary, because we were out on the streets, in the fields, in the parks, playing. Today, children don't do that because we haven't designed cities for people. They're built for cars. And this is the problem. Let's get things straight. We have increasingly little farmland. Why are we growing food for cars and not for people? That's crazy. That's really nuts.
Thank you very much, and I agree. Can I give you our campaign material?
I'm going to start trying to get a kernel of corn.
Hi, this is just a quick question, but what was the driving force, do you think, behind the demonization of the carbon tax in the last election, and how can we stop that from happening in the next
election?
Well, that's a
really good question. You know, I went to a meeting of the 20th anniversary of the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy, and I gave the keynote speech there. Preston Manning was there, Andrew Coyne was there. There were people from the press, from politics and business. We took a vote at the end of that meeting, and 85% of people agreed that a carbon tax was by far the most effective way to begin to get people to reduce their emissions. But of course, the carbon tax has been demonized by the private sector, and it's seen as a tax, and we're trying to imitate the Americans. Americans have a phobia about taxes. And what happened, well, 3 days before Mr. Dion decided to announce his green shift, I knew that he was going to announce it on the Monday. I called him 3 days before, and I begged him not to do it. What I said is, this is a very complicated thing. The media will go after you and just knock you for the complications. Why don't you just say, I believe we need a carbon tax, and if I'm elected, I will impose a carbon tax, but I will first appoint an all-party committee, because this should not be a party thing. All parties, and they should come back in 6 months with a carbon tax, the best carbon tax. And that way, I said, you could avoid getting into the scrimmage over what the details of it is and who's going to get the money. And all. But to his credit, he said, look, I believe in it. I think it's the right thing to do, and I am willing to stake my entire campaign on it. So he went ahead and did it. Now, you have the leader of a major opposition party basing his entire campaign on what everyone agrees is the most effective tool to reduce emissions. And when he presented it, what was the prime minister's response? That's crazy. And that was all we heard about the debate over this serious instrument that was proposed, and the media allowed the prime minister to get away with it. It is disgraceful what the level of discussion or discourse is in politics. All the prime minister did was dismiss it as crazy, and we let him get away with it, and then he put ads showing a bird shitting on Dion's shoulder. Boy, oh boy, am I impressed what we have in this country as our leader. And we have a very right-wing government in British Columbia. And to our absolute astonishment, Mr. Campbell invoked a carbon tax. Now, it, as I say, it's a piddling carbon tax of $10 a ton. But he imposed it, and when the election was called, it was a time, remember, when oil went up to $150 a barrel, and the price of gas in Vancouver went to $1.50 a liter. All hell was breaking loose. The NDP was poised to win that election. Their campaign strategist was a man named Jerry Scott. And Jerry Scott worked for my foundation for 10 years, heading our climate change program. And during that time, we championed a carbon tax. Jerry Scott, working for the NDP, saw that people were mad about the price of gas, and they said, axe the tax. And they then said, we're going to go against the carbon tax. And it was disgraceful. The NDP lost any credibility as a party of principle, and they went with axe the tax, and people like me, who are traditionally supporters of a party like the NDP, although I vote green all the time, but we ended up fighting the NDP. We didn't say vote NDP, but we said we support the carbon tax and we think the NDP should support it as well and take it off the table as a political issue. The Greens wanted $50 a ton. If the NDP said, yes, we want a carbon tax, it would no longer be a political issue. Well, they chose to axe the tax and fought us and demonized us and said, oh, guys like Suzuki are in bed with the Liberals and they're saying vote for the Liberals. We never said that. And they lost the election, and everyone agrees they lost the election over the carbon tax. Thank God. Now, we're still stuck with a right-wing government. But at least the NDP, after the election, said we made a mistake, and in the next election, there will be no question the carbon tax is still there. Small victory, but I think a real... It was a tragic...
Next federal election.
Well, I think that the carbon tax federally has become toxic. Mr. Ignatieff was a man who first floated the idea of a carbon tax. The minute Dion lost, Ignatieff has been backpedaling so fast, and guess what? He's now embraced the tar sands. What the hell is he doing? He knows damn well he hasn't got a prayer of winning more than two or three seats in Alberta. But he's compromised. Before he ran the first time for leadership, he called me. I talked to him in my hotel. He blew my mind with his understanding of environmental issues. He said, this is going to be one of my major focuses. But when the carbon tax lost, he's just gone running over to Alberta saying, what can I say? I love Elizabeth May. But you know, I have told Elizabeth May this many times. There shouldn't be a Green Party. The environment should not be a political issue. Why should one party say, oh, I care more about the environment than they do? It shouldn't be a political issue. It should be a part of our understanding that we absolutely depend on clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean energy, biodiversity. This is what keeps us alive. How can it become a political football? And having a Green Party there implies, oh, well, the environmental issues, that's their thing. It should be everybody's thing. So I want to get rid of the Green Party. But right now, she's keeping the issues on the burner, so thank God she's there.
David, it's a pleasure to see you here tonight. Been a long fan of yours with the nature of things and so forth. I hope to get this book signed tonight. Excuse me. I'm really happy that it's on forest-friendly paper. That's right up my alley. Ever since as a young fella, my father taught me to be an environmentalist. We'd be walking through the park or through the woods, come across some papers and pick it up, and I just think he was nuts. I'm going to be 56 next month, and I do that with my kids. Recently, just came back from down south. Actually, yesterday, we're down in the Carolinas. We got hit with Ida. Wasn't too bad. Flash floods and high winds. Everybody cleared out. This wasn't our holiday. On our way back, we spent some time in Virginia. Saw a lot of coal mines down there. They're looking for jobs for miners and stuff. And one of the topics in the local paper, I think it was the Beckley Herald, was that the higher-ups, the big boys, are getting together. I think it's in Copenhagen to talk about things, about the environment and so forth. Is that correct?
You're going to talk about climate.
Yes. What are we going to do about it? Alluding to my question would be, is last summer I stumbled across a website from a colleague. It's called Agenda 21, and I just wonder what your take was on it.
Well, Agenda 21 was the great hope of the Earth Summit in 1992. Nations from around the world spent years working on a way. That was when they said sustainable development has got to be our future. And they said from the Rio conference was meant to signal that from that point on, the environment could never be ignored in any issues that were being discussed. We had to include it as a high priority. And Agenda 1 was a massive blueprint to get us onto a sustainable path. The developing world took Agenda 21 very, very seriously. It was going to cost, for the developing world, up to 20% of their GDPs was going to have to be paid into making Agenda 21 happen. It was going to cost 0.7% of the GDP of the rich countries. But our GDPs were so big, 0.7% was still a lot of money. The poor countries were going to spend 20% of GDP on it. And they were willing to do it. But what happened? Right away, we were in a recession, and the rich countries said, we can't afford that. And it's gone nowhere.
Anyways, thanks, David. I really hope that you can sign my book.
After.
Thanks for coming here, Dave. My question is, I read a study done by the United Nations in 2006. It's called Livestock's Long Shadow. And in it, it stated that greenhouse gases emitted from livestock, animals, and the meat industry is 18%, which rivals the entire transportation industry, every plane, every bus. And so my question to you was, how can we advocate to people that they need to stop eating industrialized food, such as meat and animals and things like that?
I think food gives us a real opportunity for people to come to grips with the role that we play in terms of this whole crisis. And the reality is that meat is very, very high up the food chain. I mean, it takes a lot of grain to get 1 pound of meat, and it's very expensive in terms of water, in terms of pollution of the earth through the various chemicals that are injected or sprayed onto them. Meat is a very... plus, they fart and belch methane. So they're a very expensive way to go. And we advocate, for example, if you're not a vegetarian, give up meat just one day a week. If everybody in Canada did that, that would be very, very significant. So then, and you begin to... I mean, red meat, not only is it unhealthy for the planet, it's unhealthy for our bodies. We eat far too much red meat. And so that's an area where you confront the reality of where we contribute to the problem. You know, we are so disconnected from food, it's bizarre. We don't think anything of going into a store in the middle of winter with snow up to your armpits and buying fresh fruits and vegetables, and nobody says, Jesus, Canada's a cold country. Where the hell are these being grown? Well, of course, they're being grown halfway around the world. How can we buy an apple, a fresh apple, for less than a dollar in the middle of winter, and it comes all the way from New Zealand? Well, the reality is we don't pay the true price. We haven't added up the ecological cost of the way that we grow and ship our food around. And when I say this, people say, well, but if you did that, that apple would cost $50 each. Of course. That's the whole point. We're living in a dreamland to think that we can have fresh fruit and vegetable 12 months a year and pay next to nothing for it. It's crazy. All these things have to be readjusted. And at the heart of it is our economic system. We have people that fall down before the economy. Man, you can't suggest anything the minute someone says, but it'll destroy jobs or it'll ruin the economy. You know, that's exactly what the southern states said before the Civil War in the United States. We can't afford to abolish slavery. It'll destroy our economy. And they were absolutely right. Some things you do because they're more important than economics.
Thank you so much for coming to Hamilton. It's been a real pleasure listening to you. It was very informative to see the film, although, as my friend pointed out, probably the people that needed to see it aren't the ones sitting in the auditorium tonight.
This is a good start.
Yeah. Two-part question. One you've sort of touched on, and that's the arguments that say humans aren't the cause of global warming, that this is a natural cycle that
the Earth would go through. That argument was dispelled 20 years ago.
A second question is, I read an article, and I don't remember the details, but there was a scientist saying that wind farms would actually cause more problems to the environment because of the way they would change the direction of the wind. Do you have an argument against that?
Windmills are going to affect wind patterns. There's no question about that. Windmills do kill birds. Windmills do kill bats. So obviously, you have to site them properly. But, you know, these issues are all answered in Denmark. Denmark produces 20% of its energy. Now, they sell a lot of it, but 20% of their total energy comes from windmills. If any population is going to see the effects of negative effects of windmills, it ought to be Denmark. And I said this to Preben Maygard, who's the father of windmills in Denmark. I said, gee, in Toronto now they're saying that some obscure doctor in the United States says if you live near windmills, you get sick. There's a windmill syndrome or something like this. And he said, gee, you know, I guess the Danes must be in bad shape, but I've never heard of anything like this. The Danes have done a study on 10,000 bird kills in Denmark, and 40% of them are killed by high-tension wires or buildings. 40% are killed by cars and cats. So if people really care about birds, kill those goddamn cats. Okay? And out of 10,000 birds, 10 were killed by windmills. So let's get things settled. What these opponents are objecting to are phony baloney arguments being marshaled to say, we just don't want windmills. And for that woman to have the nerve to get up then in the film and say, oh, well, we care about global warming. Yeah, we've got to reduce. And to be exultant that they had defeated the windmills. You got to really wonder where their heads are at. And sure as hell, well, I won't say where their heads are at.
I was reading an article the other day that was talking about the hopelessness of our generation in terms of our future. And this is totally different from when I was a kid, that we didn't imagine, we thought the future would go on forever. And I guess I feel that hope is a big part in making change. So I was wondering if you could speak to the hope that you found in your
experience. I mean, the hope I find is, I don't know if any of you saw my Suzuki Diaries where I took my daughter. My daughter was always saying, oh, Dad, I listen to you and Mom and Dad. I listen to you and Mom. It's too late. And so I realized I've got to be able to show my daughter there are options. So our first film was on renewable energy, and we went to Germany, Denmark, Spain, and France. And we got dynamite ratings. People loved the film because it showed that there are countries already doing things. You know, Spain blew me away. I'd always thought of Spain as a developing country. Spain has a train system where by 10 or 2015, 90% of all Spaniards will be within a few kilometers of a major super fast train station. These trains travel over 300 kilometers an hour. It is faster to to take a train from downtown Barcelona to downtown Madrid than it is to fly. These trains are so accurate that if you buy a ticket to a train and it is more than 5 minutes late, you get a complete refund on your ticket. That means that you can live in Barcelona and call up a colleague in Madrid and say, look, I'm going to be there by 12:30. I'll see you at 1 o'clock in your office. And you'll be there. And you don't have the hassle. I mean, anybody that flies, you know what a hassle it is to go now. First of all, you got to go through security, all that stuff. Then the chance the plane leaves and lands on time, very, very remote. It's a hassle. Trains are a wonderful way to go, and they are now faster than planes. So, and that's Spain, you know, and their windmills all over. Anyway, it was very uplifting. There is a lot of hope. I wrote a whole book called Good News for a Change, Hope for a Troubled Planet. The problem is the people who should be seeing what's being done around the world don't seem to be very interested. I sent Good News for a Change to every politician in Ottawa, and I sent it to the CEOs of the 100 largest companies in Canada, and I wrote a note in each one saying, I'm sending you my book as a gift. Don't bother to write to thank me. I'll assume you do that. I want you to read it. And if you find anything in this book that you think you'd like to try applying, then please write me because I'm very interested in that. I won't depress you with how few letters I got back. People are willing to put a bandage on here or there, but they're not willing to consider a fundamental shift, even though it's sustainable.
Thank you.
Hi there. You mentioned earlier about some.
Talk into the mic, please.
Sorry. You mentioned earlier about some of the bickering between Canada and China and the APEC in Copenhagen. I was just wondering what you personally believe is the chance of a Copenhagen treaty being signed and verified, and if it even does, if, like, I mean, our conservative government actually signs it, is it just a political showing, or will it be like Kyoto? Kyoto failed, correct? So, I mean, like,
no, it's just, Kyoto
well,
did not.
It didn't meet its levels for CO2 reduction.
No, most of the countries that signed Kyoto are going to make their target.
But Canada did not.
Canada has signed and ratified in 2001. When Mr. Putin ratified in 2004, it became international law binding the 34 countries that have signed it. Canada is one of them. Mr. Harper ran on a law and order platform. And yet the first thing he said when he became prime minister was, I'm not even going to try to meet Kyoto. It'll ruin the economy. Wait a minute, Mr. Harper. When Canada signed Kyoto, Mr. Chrétien signed it as my prime minister, not as a liberal. He was our prime minister, and he ratified it and said we're committed to it. Now, Harper had every right to say the liberals talked a line, but they didn't do anything. Now it's going to be very difficult. But he is under international law obligated to meet it. What kind of law and order guy will declare immediately Canada is an international outlaw? We don't give a shit about any laws that we've already signed. Now, to give you an idea of what law and order means to this guy, remember that last parliament before the election, he passed a law saying we'll have elections every 4 years on a set date. That's Canada law. And a few months later, he broke his own law and called an election. So you got to say, what does it mean when Mr. Harper says, I believe in law and order? You got to wonder what the heck this guy is all about. Now, you asked about Copenhagen. My hope is that Copenhagen fails because Canada is the major player fighting against it. We have been fighting for years under the Harper government. We have tried to sabotage every meeting leading up to Copenhagen. We know the Prime Minister is not going. We know that Jim Prentice, the Environment Minister, has said, no, we can't even do anything to seriously meet a hard target. They're doing everything they can to bomb this process. And it would be horrible if, in order to placate Canada, we get a half-assed thing that's not binding or that's not serious. So we're all hoping it's going to fail. And Canada is going to be the major reason why, but we will then have another meeting next year and then the next year, and the hope then is we will have turned this government around and either got his attention or he won't be there anymore and things will change.
I'm going to be in Copenhagen. I'm actually on a media accreditation. I'm also the Green Party candidate in this riding. And I'm wondering, thanks. The challenge is that I meet so many people involved with different causes that, and yet they say it's apolitical. And I just ask, I say, just learn about the different policies and vote. Doesn't matter who you vote for. So do you see a shift happening around the 2012? Like, what's going to happen? An event? Conscience? Do you believe any of that?
Well, I certainly think there's been a huge shift when you compare the what you encounter at meetings, at this meeting in Geneva, for example. When I went to Kyoto in 97, and I vowed after that meeting, I'm never going to go to one of these meetings again. But in 97, the Canadian delegation, but especially the Albertans, were there in full power, saying climate change is baloney, humans aren't the cause, blah, blah, blah. And the juice cans countries, Japan, the United States, Australia, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, were fighting against any hard targets. The European Union was pushing for a 15 to 20% target below 1990 levels. Al Gore then came at the last minute and brokered this half-assed deal of 5 to 6% below 1990 levels. And now Canada is the spoiler, and we're really almost alone in this whole thing. The world has shifted enormously, and certainly the EU is way ahead of everybody, but especially the Nordic countries are leading the charge. So, and you know, in terms of Canada, I am now being invited into the boardrooms of companies that 10 years ago wouldn't have let me in their building. I was a devil to them. So something's happened. They know something's going on. Now there's a lot of greenwashing and all that stuff going on, but I believe that we're in a major transition. The problem right now is it's so slow, and it's clear we don't have much time. Now what our federal government has done is absolutely pernicious. Everybody since 1990 has agreed 1990 levels of emissions would be our standard, our baseline. And everything, when we talk about reductions, will be according to the 1990 levels. The Harper government has said, no, we've increased too much. We're going to use 2006 as our base level. So when they talk about 50% reduction by blah, 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 that's 50% above below 2006, but that's already 30% higher than 1990. So there's just all this smoke and mirrors going on. We've shifted the baseline now, and people have no idea what the hell. And the other thing is, when you start saying, I'm going to set a target for 2020 or 2050, you know damn well none of those politicians is going to be around by 2020, let alone 2050. So if we're going to have a serious target, there have to be binding ways of binding that target and making sure you're started and going on in a serious way. Because otherwise, they'll keep punting and punting and punting till the last minute, and then it'll be too late.
You're so cool.
Let me take two more questions. Is that okay? I'll take you.
Yeah, I just have a question. Like, the environmentalist community suggests that if we make subtle changes to our lifestyles, then we'll probably be okay. If we change our light bulbs, if we put more air in our tires, then maybe we'll be okay. Yeah. But in reality, in my opinion, I think it needs to be a little more extreme. Stop driving cars.
Thank you. I think you're absolutely right. The problem is this. Most of the people in the world, as is reflected by the people in this room, how many people here were born before 1945? Well, there you go. Most of the people on the planet were born after 1945. And that means you have spent your entire lives in a period of unprecedented and totally unsustainable growth and change. But that's all you've ever known. So to you, this is normal. And when people talk about we've got to be more efficient and reduce green, it's all with respect to maintaining the same standard of living that we've got now. And that's, you're absolutely right. And people like me were afraid to say the truth. And the truth is, my generation and the boomers have partied as if there's no tomorrow. We've used it up and we've lived like kings and queens. The party is over. And when the party's over, you got to sober up. You got to clean up your mess. And you don't want to go back to living the way you did before the party started. We've got to make some fundamental changes. Now, does that mean sacrifice? Do we have to sell our house and live in a cave, start making all of our own clothes? Hell no. We are so hyper-consumptive now. We have so much that we can get rid of without even feeling it in terms of the quality of our lives. But the important thing is this. If we can get through this bottleneck right now, we're at a bottleneck. If we can get through that, 95% of people in our country would prefer to live the way we're going to live. The way we're going to live is we're still going to be in cities. Our homes or our apartments are going to be smaller because we're concerned with quality of stuff. We're not going to need a car because all the action is going out on the streets. We live, work, and play in the same neighborhood. When we go on the street, there are our friends out there, either with a community garden or they're playing music or whatever they're doing. That's the way that we want to live that way. We want to be part of a neighborhood. And I think it's so we've got to stop this idea. It's going to be sacrifice and suffering. I just want to end by saying, no, maybe I'll just end it with this. I'm sorry. And that is, my father was my great hero. And when he was dying, he had a form of cancer. Thank goodness it wasn't painful. He was 85. He was completely unafraid of dying and ready to die. I moved in with him the last month of his life, and we had a wonderful time. We laughed and we cried, and every night my wife would bring slides of trips that we'd taken together with my father and show him with our kids there. And the last week, my sisters came, and we spent time with him. And all that time, he never once said, oh, you remember that closet full of fancy clothes I had? Or that big car I bought in 1967? Or the house we owned in London? He kept saying to me, David, I die a rich man. And yet it was never about stuff. All we talked about were neighbors, family, and friends, and the things we did together. And that was his wealth. And that's what life is all about. It's not about money and stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Suzuki, and thank you, everyone, for your participation.
Go. We are overwhelmed by the support we have received for this event. We would like to thank our sponsors, TD Canada Trust, who financed the screening of this film, both here at Westdale Secondary and also at Westdale Cinema next month. We'd also like to thank Bullfrog Power, who provided the power use for this event from green and alternative energy sources. We'd also like to thank the City of Hamilton, who kindly provided a hybrid vehicle and a chauffeur to collect Dr. Suzuki from Toronto.
We would also like to thank each and every one of you for your attendance and your support tonight, especially the students from the following organizations: the Dream Program, who has brought 42 students, and the Globe with 12 students. And of course, we would like to thank Dr. Suzuki for hosting the question and answer period. Do you want to come up? Okay, just go. Just go.